B.B. Warfield, wrote a paper called The Emotional Life of Our Lord. And it was a study of all the words to do with Jesus' emotions. And the most striking thing from Warfield's essay was that there was one Greek word used of Jesus' emotions which was used more than all the other words put together. More than all the other words put together, there was one word that was used of his emotions again and again and again. Compassion. Compassion.
Welcome to the Bible Explored with Rico Tice. Rico is a passionate evangelist dedicated to equipping the church to share the gospel within their local communities. He places Christ as the reason for our hope and the center of our faith as he opens the Bible for us today.
A group of artists and musicians from Britain asked thousands of people one question. The question was, what was your happiest memory? Well, the answers came in, and there were lots of first dates, first loves, memories of weddings and births, memories of holidays, faces of loved ones now lost. And as they collected these memories of happiness, they noticed three things. First, that less than 1% of the happy memories had anything to do with material things. Secondly, the memories were nearly always about relationships of one kind or another, family, friends, lovers. And they discovered the third thing when they put all the happy memories into a computer. The word that came out most often, time and again, was home. Home. The director said the shows ended up being a cross between a wedding and a wake. It was a celebration mixed with sadness because all the memories of happiness were great, but now they were gone. They hadn't lasted. And so I want to begin by stating that the Christian faith unequivocally states, ladies and gentlemen, that because of the resurrection of Jesus, the worst thing is never the last thing. In the Happiest Memory series, you always ended up at a graveyard. I mean, you know, that's where you ended. Time and again, that's where the memories end because that's where human beings end up. Unless someone rises from the dead. Unless there's hope. Jesus is able, Christians believe, to handle death, and you and I can handle it with him. How about that? That is the statement that we're making. Unequivocally, that's what we're saying. Why? Well, let's explore this hope together now. I wonder if you can look down and see verse 11 of our passage. Listen as though your life depends on it. Verse 11 describes Nain as a town. Well, actually, it's very small. It was then, it is today, it's more like a village. It was a few miles south of Nazareth, perched on a hill near Mount Tabor. But this town is never mentioned before or after in the Bible. So it only features for one reason. Jesus came and performed the first of three miracles in the gospel accounts in which someone gets raised from the dead. And I suppose the question comes out as we get to this point, you know, why pick Nain? Why pick this place for such an incredible, epoch-making, destiny-changing act? I mean, why is his first miracle indeed in Cana of Galilee turning water into wine? Cana's tiny, Nain's minute. I mean, if you want to be a world teacher, surely you'd go to Rome or to Athens or to Alexandria. Go somewhere where the message you'll get out along the big roads of the empire. You know, if you're going to make your speeches, do it there, perform your deeds there. But then, it's nothing. But this is the style of Jesus Christ. This is how he does things. He loved to work in these small, obscure places. So he gets born in Bethlehem, in an unlit stable, in an animal feeding trough, with shepherds. Why Bethlehem? Why Nan? Why you? Why dyslexic me who couldn't read until I was nine? Why? If you visit Nain, and if Jesus can go there before you, then he can visit any place and any person in life. Do you feel an outsider? Do you feel a bit overwhelmed? Do you feel in the minority? Well, Jesus wants to visit you, and he wants to give you hope. That's his style. And on this occasion, the whole town that day of Nain is out. And can we see what we've got in verse 12 as we come to it? A large crowd from the town was with her. There's this widow, and a crowd is with her. So there they are, but they're not accompanying a wedding, but a funeral procession led by a grieving widow on her way to lay to rest her only son. Her only son. Now, can you see it in your mind's eye as verse 12, as Jesus approaches, a dead person was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And I guess what we've got to do at this point, but can you imagine her grief as she walks along? Can you imagine the grief, the bewilderment, the sadness, the sense of darkness she's feeling? So she's loved this boy since he was born, and he's her only son. And she's cuddled him and she's nursed him and she's fed him and she's got up in the nights for him and she's rejoiced over him. And then suddenly, one day, finish. Done. Done. And it all comes crashing down. It all comes to a grinding halt. And this mocks how she's just spent the last few years. So she's with the procession, but really in her mind, well, it's frozen with his last breath. She keeps thinking back to that moment. She's thinking, the life I cherished for those years has been swept away. My boy's dead. I couldn't protect him. I mean, he's gone in an instant. She can't believe it. The sort of just watching the last breath and then he's gone. And she reaches down and his heart has stopped. And it's as though in the procession, she's watching herself walk along. Part of her is watching from the shadows because she knows this grief is going to crack and corrode every crevice of her human spirit. And she keeps ransacking her mind as she's there at the funeral, but walking along thinking, is there a way out of this pain? A new phase of life has arrived and it looks like a wasteland. And the landscape is barren, not least because, do you see the ominous words in verse 12? The only son of her mother, and she was a widow. Now look, there's no NHS. There's no state support. So she isn't just bereaved, she's one day going to be destitute. It's a catastrophic loss. Now, bier is a sort of open cradle, and it was what the poorest of the poor were buried in. Literally, they just sort of put together some twigs and wrapped it round the body. It might have a bit of a covering. So Jesus comes up the slope towards the town at the end of an 18-mile journey from Capernaum, where he'd just been, and he sees the large crowd approaching him. And then, if you look here in the passage, can you see what happens, verse 12? Can we see as we look down? Soon afterwards, Jesus went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a large crowd went along with him. So Jesus has a large crowd following him into Nain, this nowhere town, but there's momentum behind him. Some people have walked the 18 miles. There's momentum building behind the ministry of Jesus. I mean, some are perhaps curious about the circulating stories. They're not to be believed. They're against the laws of nature. Others have come on a personal mission to investigate. I'm going to see for myself. They heard how he'd opened up the scriptures on the Sabbath at Nazareth that day and made the breathtaking claim that the ancient prophecies were all about himself. These ancient prophecies, they're about him. Others were wondering, well, what's this person got for me? And then others, they were hearing him speak and they found that their hearts burned within them. So he says, the one who hears my words and doesn't put them into practice is like a man who's built a house on the ground without foundation. The moment the torrent struck the house, it collapsed. Its destruction was complete. And as they hear it, something inside them leaps as they go, listen to this, be warned. And they've been a paralyzed man. And Jesus had said, get up. And he got up and it was extraordinary. The muscles, the tendons were instantly knotted together without a hint of surgery. And then the Galilean underworld. Well, they'd been fascinated because one of their number, Levi, the suspect tax collector, had become a friend of Jesus. And he'd set up a massive dinner party. You going? Yeah, I'm going. What about you? Oh, yeah, I'm going. So the healings, the stories, the voice. And the word's getting around. So chapter 7, verse 2, can we see in our chapter? We saw it last week. He's even healed the dying servant of a Roman centurion. He entered Capernaum. There was a centurion servant whom his master valued highly, was ill and about to die. And Jesus heals this man from a distance. So Jesus, from a few streets away, is able to heal him. From a few streets, he wasn't even with him. He didn't lay hands on him. So a large crowd has now built up, verse 11. And can you see what's happening in the passage? What we've got here in this passage is that we've got two crowds, verse 11 and 12. You see, a large crowd went along with him, and verse 12, a large crowd from the town was with her, and good on them being with her. It's so important that you turn up when people have lost a loved one. People totally underestimate what it means to look across and say, oh, they're there to support, and they're there. So good on the crowd being with her. But they're the two crowds. One's with Jesus, they've come from Capernaum. The other are with the widow. And as the two crowds move towards each other, I wonder if you can see it in your mind's eye, everything stops around the action of Jesus. And he stops the funeral procession. Can I tell you, I've taken a few funerals, and I've had one person once do that, and it was ungovernably callous and rude. I couldn't believe it. But Jesus here, he stops the procession. It better be good. He better deliver, because this is the sort of activity that gets you hated for life. And we've already tried to ponder the terrible loneliness she is feeling. This little boy has died. She's plunging into darkness. And at a very profound level, her heart is never going to recover. And then do you see what Jesus says to her in verse 13? When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her, and he said, "Don't cry. Don't cry." The tears, the groans, the anguish, they'll feel like a black bottomless hole. She'd have been walking in front of the bier, so she's the first person he encounters. She says, "Don't cry." But please notice here as we come to this that there are two reasons in verse 13 that he says this. This is not some outrageous comment. The first is that Luke calls him the Lord Kyrios, and that's a title which emphasizes deity. So this is no mere man, no mere prophet calling her not to cry. This is the Lord of heaven and earth who has authority over death. Who's making the call? The funeral that interrupted me, I wouldn't have minded if they raised the person from the dead. That would have been fine then. I'd have apologized. But the one who's just healed the dying servant of a centurion from a distance, well, he's the one who says, "Don't cry." And the rules are different for him because he can reverse the rules of nature. Secondly, can you see what motivated Jesus to say these words? So he is the Lord. There's great power, but what else is there? You see, he's not playing games here with a grieving mother. He's no egocentric magic man. No, we read, when the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her. So nobody asked Jesus to do anything. They're just walking in from Capernaum, tired, a long walk. But moved with compassion, he took action. It's his own initiative. Do you know this great theologian, B.B. Warfield, wrote a paper. He lived 1851 to 1921. He wrote a paper called The Emotional Life of Our Lord. And it was a study of all the words to do with Jesus' emotions. And the most striking thing from Warfield's essay was that there was one Greek word used of Jesus' emotions which was used more than all the other words put together. More than all the other words put together, there was one word that was used of his emotions again and again and again. Compassion. Compassion. It literally means to be moved in the very depths of your being in love for someone. So you feel such love for them that your stomach turns. So he sees this widow and he sees this little bier, this tiny coffin, and his stomach turns. So the two crowds come to a halt and Jesus says, "Don't cry. Don't cry." And then verse 14, can we see? He went up and touched the bier. They were carrying on him on, and the bearers stood still. So he's now interrupted the funeral. So we've got the crowds, we've got the compassion of Jesus, the words to a grieving widow, don't cry, the touch of his hand upon that very simple carrying stretcher that bore the dead boy. I've been in intensive care in a hospital with a family where a young man is lying and he's, after a terrible accident, he's brainstem dead. And so the doctors and nurses are very quiet because the decision has been made, nothing can be done, that the machine be turned off. And what struck me was the medical staff were very quiet, very gentle, and they moved very slowly. And there's no more final and irreversible scene than that, unless, of course, this one. I mean, maybe this confronts you even more. That of the crowd carrying the coffin to its final resting place. Again, your stomach just drops, particularly when it's someone who's died before their time. In a film clip shown once on a TV documentary, the 20th century philosopher Bertrand Russell recalled hearing as a small boy the dying words of his unbelieving grandfather, Lord Russell, in the late 1870s. So there they were as a family gathered round the bed. They were Lord Russell's last words, and he said, "Goodbye, my darlings, forever." Goodbye, my darlings, forever. So is that what we were born for? In this, the only inhabited planet in the entire vastness of the universe, to be born, to eat, to sleep, to live, to grow, to make enough to survive as long as possible, and then to go out like a little candle flame. Is that what it's for? I mean, what else is there? Xenophanes said, guesswork is over all. Is that it? One short life and then goodbye, my darlings, forever? Is that it? Well, not so, ladies and gentlemen, in the Jesus dimension. He had the power to reverse the irreversible. And the non-Christian sources acknowledged this. They just didn't know where the power came from, but they acknowledged it was happening. So here we are. He stopped the funeral procession. He stilled the tears. He touched the bier. And now all that is required is the authoritative word. And so we see verse 14. Young man, I say to you, get up. Now, do you know, I've sat at my desk for a while this week, and I've found myself unable to describe to you how the mother must have felt. I didn't know how to write it. As her boy got up from the coffin. I mean, what would that hug feel like for a mother with her only boy? As she puts her head down into his hair and smells it again and feels the life. And as he says, I'm a bit hungry, Mum. I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine that hug? The shock, the amazement, the feelings. But do you know what she was feeling? You can barely imagine what she'd have felt. The joy, the amazement, just everything is now reversed and changing. But what she was feeling was a foretaste of what the new creation will feel like when death is thoroughly reversed. The Bible tells us that we can't imagine the joy, that it's unimaginable. So Paul the Apostle, quoting the Old Testament, writes, "No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him." So just as we can't imagine this mother's feelings at this reversal of death, so the Bible says we can't imagine the wonder of the new creation. Although what it adds is this, it says our present troubles will feel like fluff. So in 1,000 years' time, they'll just think, oh, a bit of fluff. All the pain now, that will be the wonder of it. Young man, I say to you, get up. Now, actually, In Luke's gospel, those words have been heard before. They were spoken to a paralyzed man in 5 verse 24. Get up, and he got up and took up his mat and went home. It doesn't seem to matter whether it's the healing of a cripple or the stilling of a storm or the raising of the dead. It doesn't seem to matter when the governor of the universe is speaking. So later, it would be outside a tomb of Lazarus and another raising from the dead. Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And because Jesus is the governor of the universe, he's the Lord of life and death. And it isn't that Jesus is saying, look, I have the power of life and death at my disposal. He's not saying, I can do resurrections. That's not what he's saying here at Lazarus's tomb. No, the truth is, this is what he says at Lazarus's tomb. He doesn't say, I can do resurrections. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. And this resurrection of this boy at Nain is to be seen as a pointer, a signpost to Christ's own resurrection that lay ahead. Crucial. We've got to see it. So what we've got here is just a pointer. That mother's feelings, just a pointer. But when Jesus rose from the dead, it was different from these raisings. Christ's resurrection was in no way coming back to the old life. Christ's resurrection, ladies and gentlemen, was a moving on bodily, visibly, triumphantly, eternally to a new life that would never die again. Which is why at funerals, as the minister, you say, Jesus said, I'm the resurrection and the life. Because you're proclaiming bodily, visible, triumphant, eternal triumph in the resurrection of Jesus. So this boy at Nain, well, he would die again. They would eventually have another funeral for him. Can you imagine that funeral? As people said, well, actually, long, long ago, I was at another one. He'd been brought back from death by the compassion of Jesus, but he'd been brought back to his old life. And one day, as an old man, he'd grow to be an old man, and there'd be a tombstone in Nain. And can you imagine, a sort of a month after the celebrations, his mother would say, oh, darling, you're back on the washing up rotor. Darling, homework. But of course, here's the issue. The town of Nain would never be the same again because Jesus had visited. And it gets itself into posterity because Jesus met the funeral procession. He stopped it in its tracks. And so he pointed to himself as the Lord of life. And because of the resurrection of Jesus, the worst thing is therefore never the last thing. The worst thing is never the last thing. Let me close now. Do you know the whole theme of this chapter 7 of Luke's gospel that we're looking at is recognition. Who is this man? Who is he? What difference does he make? So first, the centurion in verses 6 to 8 recognizes the authority of Jesus. And he says, look, I've got a tight relationship with the emperor, so I have his power. His power comes straight down to me. And I see you, Jesus, and you've got a tight relationship with God. In fact, you probably are God. So just say the word. So the centurion looks at him and Jesus says, I've never seen such faith as this. I'm amazed. And now the whole town at Nain is challenged. Who do they think he is? I mean, what would have happened in the pub that night? You imagine, there'd have only been one in the village. What do you reckon they were talking about? No, he was definitely dead. I don't think the boy was dead. He was definitely dead. I laid him in the brier. He was definitely dead. Really? He was sleeping. I mean, he's always been a bit of a dull boy. He was dead! And then John the Baptist comes along, you see, because John the Baptist, who's this great prophet of Jesus, but he comes along, and even on recognition, John the Baptist says, actually, as he goes along, he says, are you the one who's to come, or should I expect someone else? So as he goes along, you know, and Jesus says, the blind are receiving, verse 22, can we look down, are receiving their sight, the lame are walking, those with leprosy are being cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise. It's all about recognition. And so what happens now, you see, at this point in time is that we've got to go for the twos. Luke always goes for the twos. Two men go to pray. There are two sons. time and again it happens. There are two thieves on the cross. Well, there's a pair here. And you and I are in one of the two large crowds facing each other that day at Nain. You see, the crowd coming out of Nain, and it's great they're there, but they're in grief, they're in ignorance, they're in despair. Ultimately, they're all crying with Lord Russell, "Goodbye, my darlings, forever." Are you in that crowd? Because that's all you've got left. "Goodbye, my darlings, forever." That's one of the crowds. It's lovely they're there. They're to be commended. They're with her. They're being deeply human. But "goodbye, my darlings, forever." That's the echo through the crowd. The other crowd following Jesus is full of inquiry. It's full of trust. It's there in discipleship. But above all, there's hope. There's hope. So here are these two large crowds. Here they are. One is, well, death facing life, despair facing hope. That's how they are. And so as we close, we have to ask, well, with which crowd shall we identify? Which crowd are we in? These two crowds. And you know, you're either in one or the other. You have to identify with one or the other, either with death or with life in Christ. Two large crowds. Which one are you in?
You've been listening to Bible Teaching by Rico Tice from Christianity Explored Ministries. To find out where there's a course running in your area, go to the website christianityexplored.org. To listen again or catch up on other episodes, visit premier.plus.